Hello, and welcome to Don't Pee on Your Leg and Other Scientific Misconceptions, where every episode we discuss some scientific misconceptions with the hope of you learning something you didn't already know about the world.
I'm here with my co-host, Camden Mucus Boy, Hans Lickbert.
Got yourself on that one. And I'm here with my co-host, Margaret. Did I do my research in time? Yes, I did. Hans Lickbert.
And all the way from across the pond, it's David. My daughter's name is Eris Martinez.
Welcome to the show. David,
hello.
Welcome back.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
The last time that we recorded together, we were in our Airbnb in London visiting David. And now David's back and we're all in Kansas together visiting our families.
Yeah. We were in Willesden Green.
I know. That was a much more exotic location to record it. But I will say that we're right now inside a sound booth at a library, which is pretty cool. They also have a green screen. They have a maker space. They have like 3D printers. They just got, I think, a sewing machine. So
plug for local libraries everywhere.
That actually was what I was excited about.
Oh, darn.
Well, that's fine. No, you jumped right into it.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm right now looking out onto a scene of teens and adults running the show in this maker space run by a local engineering firm. It's pretty cool. We tried out a lot of things. We were dismantling this entire room and we can see into it, obviously, because I can see them. I'm pretty sure we have made them very concerned with how many of their pieces of equipment we've taken apart.
Yep.
They have incredibly like nice looking equipment, and yet we rearranged everything to make it suit our needs.
There's this like beautiful sound like board, and that we're not, we just put all our trash on it and we're on the separate little table recording from it. So
we never did hook up the synthesizer, so I'm going to have to provide those on my own.
Oh, please do.
Somewhere, someone just ran off the side of the road. David, what are you excited about this week?
I am excited about, I think this still counts. It's still sort of within a week. I have a new baby nephew.
Yay!
Oh.
Burp, burp. We'll work on it.
This is an off-brand
synthesizer. We're hitting a lot of different synthesizers.
Yeah, my sister had a baby like a little over a week ago now. So,
yay!
And he's adorable. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. How many times have you seen him?
Ooh, 4 or 5 maybe?
Cute.
Yeah. A few times in the hospital and a couple times since then.
Oh my gosh.
Being the one who probably went through the most just like emotions and feelings day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What surprised you about like that experience? Was there anything that you weren't expecting?
I think how easy it was. Everyone talks up how difficult and painful the whole process is, and like the urges and the things you can't eat and the cravings. But I really honestly didn't have to change much about the way that I live.
That's really powerful to hear from you.
Thank you. I hope that it encourages people everywhere to become uncles themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Being an uncle is way less painful than a lot of people told me it would be. So welcome.
Yeah, I've got to say that, you know, I haven't seen you in a while, but it doesn't seem like you've put on that weight that they always talk about. So
I'm so glad you didn't notice.
Yeah.
Thank you. There's a little bit of a sympathy weight in there. But
Sure. Well, you've done a great job.
You got a full night's sleep.
I did. Yeah. I'm running on a good 9.5 hours or so.
Just like a new uncle.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
that sweet, sweet new uncle sleep. Great.
Thanks. I'm looking forward to all the additional presents that I'll be getting this Christmas. Uncle presents.
Yeah.
Presents for David and presents for Uncle David.
Yeah. That's great. Well, congratulations, David.
Thank you very much.
To you. And then also, you know, I guess to your sister and the baby, but mostly to you.
Margaret, what are you excited about?
I'm excited to just be back here in Kansas, and it's really cool to see, I don't know, we haven't been back in a little bit, but to see snow, honestly. It's been really beautiful. It snowed, what do you think, about like a foot maybe on Sunday?
And pretty close to it.
A lot of snow.
It's really nice because it's that kind of nice situation where there's still snow on the ground, a pretty significant amount, but the roads are pretty good. Mm-hmm. So you can still go places, but you know, when you wake up, you're like, oh, look at that beautiful snow-covered tree. So it's been great. And I'm also, of course, excited to see friends such as this young Martinez boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're staring at him from across the room because
we hate each other.
One, we hate each other. And two, we looked like we were slowly going insane because there was this high pitched humming that just we couldn't shake. And so we were like on the ground, mm-hmm. holding the mic up high, moving closer, like, moving further away.
It looked like, you know, when they put collars on lions and then they have to go out in the field and track them with the antenna.
Yeah.
The you know, that's what it was like.
Okay. You know, that story really came around to save you because for a while I was like, no, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Just the look of like the dazed and confused look that lions get when they go to a new place. It's like, what? This isn't where I parked.
Yeah. And plus they can just hear all the like background noise that humans can't pick up. Yeah. So
lions are really easily irritated by small humming.
Misconception.
And this podcast is for you. The lions. Oh, so now we're going to head into.
He's surprised.
She got surprised by the new segment that we're doing this time. It's called, Margaret, why don't you tell them what the new segment is?
It's called The Misconceptions. You know, I'm just delighted every time. So let's head into the main segment of the show. One that's been a feature for, you know, a long time.
Enough to not be surprised by it coming up.
So every episode, we each bring a new scientific misconception to the table to share, discuss, and explain. So as always, none of us have heard what the misconception is going to be. We might have given each other like a one-word clue, but besides that, nobody knows what anybody else is going to do. So you get to learn along with us. So we're going to flip a coin.
Or flip a thing. Let's take another part of this building apart.
Let's flip that iMac.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. Heads is it breaks. Mm-hmm. Tails is lands on the USB.
Well, you just
side.
Got a new Kansas City beanie. Do you want to flip that? Like, but there's three of us.
Oh. Well, you can do best out of three. Like, two of us and then the other two?
Why don't we flip it the heart, like heart or no heart up between you two, and then the winner of that faces me. And the winner gets to go first.
Okay. No heart. Yeah. Heart. No heart.
Oh, no heart. Heart. So it's Cayman versus me. We're flipping it in the air.
The heart is a very tiny bit.
All right. No heart.
Okay. I said call it.
No heart.
I can see the heart. Does that matter? I can see the entire heart.
Yeah, that counts. That counts. All right. Heart. I said no heart. So Cameron, you go first, then
for
David, then me? Then me, then David.
Then you, then me.
Okay, yeah. Great.
For avid listeners out there, this is Uncle Cammy's like ninth time going in first.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's true.
Whoever's keeping track of the wiki for this podcast.
Yeah.
Mark it.
There's an like probably two people who listen to the show who are going, yes. They might even do like fantasy sports for this.
Oh, I doubt it.
If they're tracking guest appearances, by the way, I believe I've now tied.
Yes,
right?
You are tied. You are back into tie.
Mm-hmm. I'm back into tie
with Jordan
and Brooke.
Well, let's hurry up and do a few of these so I can just extend my lead while I'm here.
Go ahead and fast forward episode 26 where David shows up with an eerily sounding similar. Misconception.
Or I was gonna say where he just does like six misconceptions in a row in one episode. All right, Camden.
Just cut it up.
Start us off.
All right, everybody. Have you ever had food?
Yep.
Placed it in your mouth and said, "Youch, that's spicy."
Yes.
Yes. Is the word meatball followed?
I thought Alec Baldwin might come hunting for me, so okay. I decided not. No, wait, that's not Alec Baldwin.
No.
Who says that? Steve Martin? I don't know. SNL. Here we go. Spicy things. I've had a spicy pepper. Why so spicy?
I'm not sure if you're asking us or making a statement on society.
Is that the Guy Fieri Joker impersonation?
Why?
It's fine.
That joke was so good we broke the mic.
No, it's fine.
It's cobbled together. Don't touch it.
No touching.
Why so spicy? That's not good.
It was worth it. No, it was worth the wait.
Worth the joke. We're breaking the mic.
Yeah.
Why so spicy? Why is it spicy? Someone answer me.
Why are things spicy? Scoville. Yeah, Scoville is like the only thing I know about spiciness.
Okay.
And so the names of a lot of peppers.
Mm-hmm.
Scovilles.
Mm-hmm.
Not a town in Tennessee. Scovilles are, come on, no?
Is that a thing? Is that a joke?
Yeah, like Scoville.
Oh.
No. Cut it, David. Right. Cut it out.
Yeah, do we have a dump button?
Oh, no.
David got the synthesizer working. So Scovilles are, well, I learned, I was like, I knew it measured spiciness. It measures the number of heat-producing alkaloids in a pepper. The alkaloid we are most...
scary.
Oh, I thought you were just like, no way.
No, it's so spooky.
The alkaloid we are most familiar with that makes spicy things spicy is capsaicin.
Yeah. Mm. That's what's in all the chili peppers.
Yep. And so we're mostly going to talk about capsaicin today. I should clarify that there are other alkaloids in peppers that are not capsaicin. They're capsaicinoids.
Mm.
But I'm not going to mention those today because A, I didn't go down that rabbit hole. And B, I wouldn't have done it justice to properly explain the difference.
Right.
Can you give us like a one sentence explanation of an alkaloid? What is an alkaloid?
That'd be great.
Yeah. So I'm really glad you asked that because I did write it down because I didn't really have a clear definition. It is a large class of organic compounds. Organic is just a very fancy word for has carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So many things are organic. It's found in a lot of pharmaceuticals. It's high in nitrogen, although they made a point of saying that it's not necessarily a protein, although there was some semantic debate of whether it is or not. So I didn't care to
of whether debate. An alkaloid is a protein.
Yeah, because a lot of proteins are high in nitrogen. Like they have to have nitrogen in them to have an amino group. And then there are some people saying, well, if it has nitrogen, are they actually like a type of amine? And then I just stopped caring. So for anyone who
that's a scientist
even slightly about biology, they probably cared about that part. Sorry. We're not going to go into more of that. So that's an alkaloid. Capsaicin is that. Scoville's measure essentially like the amount of capsaicin in it. So why are they hot? The misconception here today, because you both didn't say it.
Oh, sorry.
Is that the hottest part of a pepper is
the seeds.
Very good.
Thank you.
So capsaicin.
I was going to say the center, I'm going to be honest, but the center is
seeds. Yeah. So this hottest part, people say, is the seeds. Actually, if you've ever looked at certain peppers, you'll see these yellowish veins going through them. I think jalapenos are a good example.
Like the ribs?
No.
Is that what they're called? Like the things, the kind of ridges along the inside, right?
I think of it as the ribs, like that the seeds like are attached to. Yeah. Like the whitish parts. Is that what you're talking about or different?
No. There's actually like yellow. Like if you've ever looked at like a jalapeno you might get like at a baseball game.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's sometimes it's got like a yellowish tint to parts of them.
Okay.
We're talking on the inside, right?
Yes, no, on the inside, mm-hmm. on the fleshy inside. So that is actually capsaicin. And so they have little veins that produce capsaicin in them. So supposedly, like if you've ever had a jalapeno and thought, wow, this one's way hotter than another jalapeno I've had,
mm-hmm.
they produce different amounts of capsaicin. Supposedly some peppers like jalapenos, you can just kind of look at them and the more yellowy they look, the hotter they're going to be.
I'm going to look for that next time.
Yeah,
me too.
I never noticed that before.
Yeah, I didn't either. Never thought anything about it. Turns out we're going to bust this myth right away. The seeds cannot be the spiciest part because they do not have the gene turned on to produce capsaicin.
Oh.
So already that myth is busted.
I know so many Latinos who like are incorrect. I'm Latino. This is an audio podcast. I guess I should clarify that it's not, I can say this.
Describe yourself to them.
Yeah. That like everyone always thinks the seeds are the hottest part.
Well, that's why, like, I feel like I've read recipes where they're like, make sure you scrape the seeds out.
Yeah.
Or like, you can scrape as many seeds out as you want it to be, like, as like you can handle the heat, you know?
Yeah.
And so to not insult this, like, actual, like, wisdom that people have of like, no, hold on a second. I've scraped the seeds out and then it has tasted not as spicy.
Milder. Mm-hmm.
There is a reason for that.
Hmm.
David, you alluded to it earlier. What area of the
pepper
are the seeds generally in
the center along those kind of rib things?
Yep. And so by scraping out seeds, you are also probably scraping out the fleshier parts that have the capsaicin. Mm-hmm.
Which I do when I am messing with a pepper. I do like cut out those ribs as well, usually.
So in a sense, it does work. So it's not like, not saying that didn't work.
But it's not
because of the seeds themselves. So they did. But so then there's this other question, like, someone is probably saying right now, like, well, I've cut open lots of peppers and they are not all yellow on the inside. Mm-hmm. What is that? So, for example, the ghost pepper or like the Carolina Reaper are like two of the hottest peppers I can think of.
David, you forgot to press the ghost synthesizer button.
The ghost pepper. And the Carolina Reaper. David hit the wrong button.
It's fine. Keep going. Sorry. Okay, sorry. Thanks, David.
Yeah.
So those ones are at over a million Scovilles. Ooh. If you've watched, or if you know about peppers, you know it's a lot. If you've watched, the only reason I know that's a lot is because of
the Hot Ones.
Hot Ones, the YouTube channel.
Mm. Have you watched that, David?
No, I haven't. It seems self-explanatory.
Yeah, yeah. It's a plug. It's basically a talk show where they celebrities eat hot.
Like insanely spicy chicken wings.
And like the last one or two are over a million.
Yeah.
So
does the scale have a cap to it? See what I did there?
No. I mean, probably. There's probably like the hottest one they found so far, but someone who was cultivating Carolina Reapers. I was reading an article. Was also like working. He's like, wait till 2014. This was an old article.
What does he sound like?
Wait till 2014. I'm going to make the hottest pepper you've ever done seen.
Wow.
Oh, accent work for those who enjoyed the last episode. It's coming back. So they found, so this is great. It was a research study in the Journal of Horticultural Sciences, 2015. They did fluorescent microscopy to look at, because you can't see the yellow in a lot of these peppers. Mm. So they like fluoresced the capsaicin. They actually made the gene like the glow. Mm-hmm. They actually use jellyfish protein. A lot of these, the jellyfish that glow. Mm-hmm. They found that in the really hot peppers like ghost peppers, Carolina Reapers, the capsaicin is not just like in those veins near the seeds. They are distributed across the skin of the pepper.
So you can't scrape it out, basically.
And that's why people might be saying, well, I've scraped those seeds out and it's still hot as heck. Yes, because it's not just, whereas jalapenos are more like in the middle stuff.
So it's spread, the capsaicin spread throughout, but it still has like areas of concentration, right? Like higher concentration than others.
It seemed for the really hot ones, like it's like all over. It's more just like if you eat a piece of it, you're just going to get hit with heat. Yes, I think there's still more concentrated parts, but less so than like a jalapeno or like a bell pepper where you can really like remove a lot of the spice.
Okay. Cool. Wow.
They called it, one thing that I just thought was just like such a plant science word, the word for that area where most of the capsaicin one are the placental veins.
Cute.
So,
and then Dibs, band name.
New nephew.
Oh, so, little placental veins.
Oh.
New band name. spicier things. I think I've mentioned this before. There's like studies that have shown that people who associate spice with pleasure also tend to be like thrill seekers. People who find like roller coasters and like extreme sports more like exhilarating. And then there's a lot of new research going on still currently, so I'm not going to say anything definitive here. Another 2015 study showed that there might be an association with age, like you live longer by eating spicier foods. Capsaicin has for a long time, because it is an alkaloid, which is in a lot of medicine, has been used in Bengay, I learned, to relieve muscle aches. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot of promising research right now about is it a useful drug in other sorts of medicines?
Wow. Is it in its form as capsaicin?
Or synthetic. There's like Bengay, for example, uses a synthetic capsaicin. Okay. But
They're not taking syringes to bell peppers.
God help them. Bell peppers famously hate needles.
Callback, right?
I was throwing away the notes Marcus used to go.
Thanks, Camden.
Yeah.
So now as you're preparing your... When will this air?
Happy December 27th, everybody.
Aww, hope you had a good Christmas.
Yeah. If you're preparing peppers with your leftovers, just really get out the whole inside, not just the seeds.
Or if you really like it spicy.
Yeah. Or if you're eating a ghost pepper with your Christmas goose.
Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
Just eat that.
Eat that guy. Yeah. Because it's everywhere.
Don't touch your eyeballs. All right. So
can we snip that out?
What?
Just don't touch your eyeballs.
Don't touch your eyeballs. That's a useful piece of information. All right. So I thought about, given the time of year, I thought I would do a Christmassy, like wintry misconception. And I thought I'd do something about snow. And then I got bored by that. So I have decided to go with the very Christmassy theme of my misconception, which is the idea that embalming makes you last forever.
God bless us,
Merry
everyone.
Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Scrooge.
So let's talk about embalming.
Please.
Someone's bound to do it.
Can you actually grab my book over there, please? So last week, I think for my what I'm consuming, I mentioned I'm consuming this amazing book by Mary Roach called Stiff, which is about the subtitle is The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. And it's like all the things that human cadavers can do and be after people have died. So a lot of what I'm going to present comes from her book, which I would strongly recommend everyone read. And then I also got some information from How Stuff Works and from Vice as well. Oh, and from, I think, funerals360.com.
Nice.
Only the best.
As if they don't have an agenda.
Yeah. So let's talk about embalming, and then we'll get into the misconception. So what's embalming? Well, it is the science of treating and preserving remains. They can be of an animal or human nature, although humans are animals. And according to funerals360.com, there are three common purposes of embalming: temporary preservation, the restoration of the body, and sanitation of the body. But sanitation of the body is really only necessary if the person died from a contagious disease. So when do you most often think about embalming? Like when would normal people like run across it in their lives?
Dead.
When they're dead? Sure. Maybe.
Do you mean like a period in history?
No, I mean like for non-funeral directors, for people who aren't like involved in the science of death, when would a regular person ever come across the embalming process?
Well, hopefully when they're dead.
Maybe.
Or like, I guess if a loved one, like a parent or something has passed on and they need to decide what to do with the body.
Like a funeral.
Exactly. Yeah. Like a funeral. Okay. Yeah. And if you're like weighing your options for what to do about a loved one. Yeah, exactly. So, many people probably, like, I know I've been to an open casket funeral, where that's happened. And, so embalming became more commonplace, I learned, during the Civil War. Before that, it was most common to just bury soldiers where they were found. But then loved ones started saying like, well, I'd really like to bury them here in my hometown. Mm-hmm. And then they would ship them back to their hometowns. By the time they got there, they were really poorly, like they were badly decomposed. They were not like, you know, I'm sure it was a very scarring experience all around for someone. So they started embalming as a way to like temporarily preserve them as they made their journey from the battlefield to their home.
Okay.
So
I'm picturing like preserved meats, like transferring preserved meats.
Like in a barrel of salt, like a pioneer.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get into exactly what it is. So really when you get down to it, specifically embalming is a process that involves injecting a body with chemicals, otherwise called embalming fluid, in order to make the person's body not look like a dead person anymore.
Okay.
So embalming is often also accompanied by the grooming of the deceased person. So basically preparing them for that open casket funeral in a lot of cases, making them look like they did so that maybe relatives can have this like last moment of, you know, oh, this is the person I love. Yes, I see them. And this is some, maybe some closure. However, like when they groom them, it's not there's a lot going into it that when you look at them, you're like, oh, they look very nice. But the process to make them look natural and normal is not natural or normal.
Yeah.
So for example, and if you're squeamish, I'm sorry. You know, your eyes, your whole, when a person dies, their whole body kind of shrinks down because you're losing a lot of like that liquid. You're losing kind of like that, like just the stretchiness of your skin. You just get a little bit more shrunken. And so your eyes tend to also get a little bit shrunken. So embalmers will put cotton balls in your eyes to kind of puff them up a little bit. And then they'll put something called eye caps on top of them. Mm-hmm. I was telling you about this today when I was reading it in the book. And eye caps are domed like your eyes, but they have little hooks on them so that when you when a person like closes another person's eyes over them, they won't open up again.
Yeah, they don't pop open.
Exactly.
Yeah. No Christmas miracles at that place.
No.
And I remember your eyes get like a little bit milky and cloudy too. Yeah. Kind of white walkery.
Yeah. So yeah. You don't want, for a lot of reasons, you wouldn't want like your
an open eye
loved one's
casting.
Eyes yeah. to be open. Yeah. And then you also need to wire the jaw closed.
Yeah.
Because otherwise their mouth will be open because there's nothing like holding it closed anymore.
There's like a whole thread needle nose chin thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Again, sometimes necessary, I guess, but not natural. And then also doing things, you know, like shaving their faces, they'll put makeup on them, etc. So what's the embalming process like? And again, sorry, skip this. If you're squeamish, come back to us in like 10, 15 seconds. So according to Mary Roach's book, the mortician finds the carotid artery in the neck and cuts a small slit in the neck and then brings a little piece of that artery out of the neck, cuts it, and then connects that artery, because it's a main one, it's a big one, connects it to a pump of embalming fluid. And okay. So they're filling that body up, like the arteries and the blood vessels up with...
Now imagine when they bring the artery out, it's not like blood gushing out because the heart's not pumping anymore.
Exactly.
So there's not going to be.
Yeah. Okay. It's, she describes it in the book.
Boy,
like,
wouldn't that be surprising?
It would be, something has gone wrong.
Whoops.
And they're a murderer. Whoops.
Oh no.
Perfect use of the synthesizer, David. She describes it like just very like clinical. Yeah. There's no blood. It's just like, you know, just part of the job. So I was surprised to learn that the embalming fluid, it usually contains a significant amount of formaldehyde, which you might know, but it also can be red in color so that it, when it's flowing through that person's body, or at least in that person's body, it's giving them a little bit of like pinkness to their cheeks.
So it's artificial coloration.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So come back if you skipped. I think it gets better from here on out.
They can't hear us.
Come back. Come back now.
We're waving our arms
at
you.
Come back, please.
Now they think we're really insane in the sound booth.
The embalming fluid not only gives a pink color to a person's cheeks, but it also, like I said, inflates their arteries, inflates their blood vessels, and inflates them as a, you know, inflates them in general. Because like I said, when they die, you can get a little bit shrunken down. And I learned that 1 gallon of embalming fluid is used per 50 pounds of a person's weight.
Wow.
It's a lot of formaldehyde.
That's a lot.
It's a ton. We'll get to that in a second.
How many pints are in a gallon?
There's two
pints in a quart.
2 pints in a quart.
4 quarts in a gallon.
So eight
pints to a gallon.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have slightly more than 1 gallon of blood in your body to begin with. Don't you have 10 pints?
Yeah, 9, 10. Yeah, something like that.
So it's 1 gallon of this stuff per 50 pounds of body.
Mm-hmm.
So you're especially pumping.
Yeah.
You're like 4 amounts worth of blood in you.
You're overcompensating. We've got formaldehyde. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a lot. And then sometimes the body after that is massaged to like keep it moving around your body.
That is a job.
That's a job. It's a job. So how long does it last? Since that's the misconception. You know, it does not last that long. It generally lasts long enough for the family to have a funeral, and then that's pretty much it. There are cases in which, like, say a cadaver is being used for an anatomy lab, but not right away. Mm. They can kind of do the embalming process, but on steroids, so they can last for, like, months, maybe years, but they're not worried about how that cadaver looks physically, so they... you basically couldn't apply it to a cadaver that you wanted to do an open casket for, because that process is different and it doesn't matter how they appear. So why don't they last forever? Well, any water, any moisture that's introduced into the casket will reverse the effects of embalming. And no matter how great the coffin is, moisture will get in there eventually. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to read this part from Mary Roach's book. So she says basically that the decomposing agents in a body are too tough to be destroyed by the embalming process. They're just too hardy. So let me find this little passage in here.
We're talking about like bacteria and organisms and stuff.
Yes, okay. Indeed. Yes. So she says, quote, "The body may contain bacteria spores, hardy suspended animation DNA pods, able to withstand extremes of temperature, dryness, and chemical abuse, including that of embalming. Eventually, the formaldehyde breaks down and the coast is clear for the spores to bring forth bacteria." Hmm. So it just can't be stopped. It's a part of life. It's part of death. You will decompose. You will. So I also found it interesting. She writes in the book that embalmers used to make claims that they would last, that bodies would last forever if they've been embalmed.
It's like an infomercial.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guarantee you four months of your money back.
which has a lot of questions. Like, why do you want that? Will you be checking up? Like, what's going on? What's happening? And so they said, yep, it'll last forever. Permanent, always beautiful. And so I guess, and I don't know what year this was, but one guy was like, oh, really? And so his mother was embalmed and she was put in a, like a mausoleum with kind of like drawers you could open. Mm-hmm. And so every 6 months, apparently he would go and like have a sandwich and like have a picnic with her and check in on how she was doing. And
so food seems unnecessary. Yeah, you know what you're going to see.
So that adds an extra layer of this man needs a little bit of...
Someone should talk to him. Someone should talk to him.
Hobby, maybe.
Yeah. But he checked up.
Having lunch with mom. They're like, your mom died 3 years ago, right?
Exactly.
Yes. And I'm going to see if she looks the same.
Yes, but I have chicken salad today.
So he went every 6 months, checked up on her, had lunch with her. And sure enough, like in about a year, like there had been moisture that got into her coffin and there was
from all that soup.
I won't tell you about what she looked like, but suffice it to say that he was able to, I believe, sue that embalming company for saying that it would last forever. And then from that point on, embalming fluids don't do that. However, embalming fluid companies do hold competitions for the best like chemical makeup.
Oh, it's like a corporate softball league.
It is.
Oh my God.
It is.
A corporate softball.
Oh. Hey.
Burr, 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 burr.
Wow.
So that's a lot about embalming. No, it does not last forever. There's so much more to go into. I could talk about it for a long time, but my kind of conservation corner about this is, you know, there's a lot of ways.
Don't
go ahead and spin this.
There's a lot of ways to have things happen to your body after you've died and you've abandoned it because you don't need it anymore. And there are lots of ways that don't involve leaching formaldehyde into the earth. Like, do you really want that to be your lasting legacy? Is like gallons and gallons of formaldehyde from your temporarily preserved body leaching into the groundwater? Like, do you really want that? Is that what you want? Yeah. I don't. I'm not going to make the decision for you. But it is a problem. Like, I found this article from Vice that's titled "Flooded Corpses Are Leaking Formaldehyde into Northern Ireland's Groundwater." These toxic chemicals, they're being washed off decomposing bodies in waterlogged coffins. And it's a problem not only in Northern Ireland, of course, but everywhere.
I imagine it's especially a problem when bodies, coffins are not in like mausoleums and stuff because they can't control how the water flows out.
Yeah, if the water table rises, it's an issue. So I would suggest looking at other ways to, you know, handle your body after you've died. Maybe as Mary Roach advocates in this book, like donating it to science.
They're shot into space.
Did they do that?
Not yet.
I mean, they won't make it. Try.
But there's a lot of places that are now allowing composting of human remains, like Washington now allows composting of human remains. So you just compost naturally, which sounds like a good deal. So just look into it, weigh all your options, but just try to have less of an impact after you've passed from this world into the next one.
Ooh. Is it still embalming just if like someone passes and the funeral is going to be like a few days away? Like, do you still have to embalm just for that?
Or
even if it's going to be a closed casket, for example?
I don't think you have to if it's going to be a closed casket. No, there are some, I was reading, there are some regulations where if like a body is going to be transferred from state to state, they have to be embalmed for that to happen. I think Kansas is one of those places where if you get a body from somewhere else, it needs to be embalmed before it gets here. So there are lots of little regulations that I don't know necessarily the rhyme or reason of, but, there are some cases like that it's mandated. So Merry Christmas. don't pollute that groundwater. David, what's your misconception?
That was lovely. That was enjoyable. Mine is fairly short and has a gross element to it too.
Great.
You guys poop, don't you?
I have been known to.
Uh-huh. Right up there. And you maybe have been known to use a sink once or twice?
Not at the same time. No.
What happens when you maybe you make yourself a bath?
Uh-huh.
And these are all related, I promise. Uh-huh.
So there's a bath, a sink, and a poop.
And a poop.
Go ahead.
They walk into a bar.
I'm trying to understand the systems here.
No, maybe you draw yourself a bath and you fill the bathtub up with water. And then you're all done with the bath. You climb out and you're ready to dispose of that. Well, listen, some of us are smaller than 6'10" Amazon Camden over there. All right.
We're really getting a good picture of all of our like physical appearances today.
Picture Smeagol or Gollum, and then you'll get a good idea of me and my my
you're
figure.
Gonna say, picture Gollum, but 6'10".
No, and I was like, Gollum would have to climb out of a bathtub.
Yeah, he would. But you are not.
Go ahead.
All right, no, so you've climbed out.
You've climbed out, and you need to dispose of that dirty, mucky, gross water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you will pull the little drain thing, the little stopper, and the water will start to go. Whoosh, 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 whoosh. That was the synthesizer. I found that sound effect on the
I found one that I think is more accurate, which is like.
Okay. It's like drawing capsaicin out of a pepper. Well, when the water starts to go whoosh, 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 and spin its way down, which way does it spin?
Oh, this is a good one, David.
It depends on the hemisphere I've been incorrectly told.
Yep. You got a 50-50 shot here. I'm going to say clockwise.
As the wind blows.
As the crow flies.
As the crow flies. Clockwise, I say.
Do you say that?
I have been told that for some reason in the northern hemisphere it turns one way, in the southern hemisphere it turns the opposite way because of the Coriolis effect. But if you ask me right now what the Coriolis effect, I'll say Margaret.
And I'll say David.
And I will say, I have a note to tell you exactly what the Coriolis effect
is.
Because you are correct. You have invoked the correct effect that is happening and causes this myth. And in fact, people sometimes make money on this myth conception by being... Has that never been coined before on this podcast?
Hashtag myth conception. Ooh, ooh.
TM. He's not leaving the sound room until he signs it over.
On the equator and like have a bucket of water or something with a little drainage thing.
I've seen these on YouTube.
Yeah. They'll like go on either side of the equator and try and do it for tourists and make money off of it and that kind of thing. But it's not true. So, mostly not true. It's like 99% not true. And I'll come back to that in a second. So it is because of the Coriolis effect, right? Do you have any like concepts about what the Coriolis effect has to do with or?
Wind.
You're whispering, but into a microphone.
Wind.
Or
no, it was wind. You got it. Yeah, it's wind.
Or not wind.
I mean, you can keep guessing, but it's wind. Yes. So this comes from the larger scale where we see like storms, especially. So tornadoes partly, but especially hurricanes, typhoons, tropical storms, they're spinning when we watch them on a weather map. And they do, in fact, spin. I want to make sure I get this right. Ooh, I find it in your notes, David. They spin counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere, north of the equator.
Okay.
So counterclockwise. And clockwise in the southern hemisphere. So tropical storms and hurricanes and typhoons do that. They spin opposite directions. And that's largely this myth has kind of made its way down to this level and saying that, well, if you are having water go down the sink, it's also going to spin the same direction as these hurricanes and typhoons.
Have they... Sorry, David noticed my face was quizzical. like, have they actually seen, I'm just imagining like a hurricane that just crosses that equator line. Is it that exact? Like, will it switch direction right then?
That's a good question. Definitely. I don't know, but I think largely hurricanes don't, the paths that they follow typically doesn't don't involve them going across the equator.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And in fact, they really wouldn't because of how most of those currents are going. And
like, it wouldn't, they have momentum, right? Like, it'd be weird for them to just like fizzle out all of a sudden because they have to change directions.
Yeah. And it'd be hard, I think, for them, this might be complete and utter nonsense, for them to like go over the widest part of the earth and keep going. I don't know.
We'll follow up on that.
Yeah.
If you're a hurricane, email us. Tell us about your experiences.
Don't be on your leg at gmail.com.
Thank you.
Hurricanes don't have opposable hands. Well, thumbs, fingers.
Voice text it then.
Yeah, there you go. Use Siri. okay. So just as like a simpler picture of how the Coriolis effect works, if you picture the Earth as a sphere spinning. Well, it is a sphere. You don't have to picture it as a sphere. Picture the Earth. And it's spinning from west to east, right? So it's always west direction moving to the east direction, which is left to right if you think of the Earth as the normal, the traditional orientation. And because it's a sphere, that the points on the middle around the equator, around the widest part of the Earth, are spinning faster around the axis than points farther up towards the poles.
Okay.
So as you move towards, it's the same on a circle. If you have a two-dimensional circle, the points on the perimeter are going to be spinning around if you spin that circle faster than points in the center.
Okay.
You can picture this like on a merry-go-round. If you've ever been on a merry-go-round, right? You're going to be spinning faster from, you have a higher velocity if you're on the outside of that merry-go-round than if you're on the inside.
The reason, let me give you another idea.
Yeah.
I have a 10-foot pole. Would you rather get, and I'm swinging it around in a circle horizontally in the middle of a big park.
Dangerous.
Would you rather get hit with the very end of it or the nub right near my hand?
Neither. I poke you in the eyes before you have a chance to hit me with it.
I'm going to call the cops.
yes, so that's correct. That's how the Coriolis effect works. And those equatorial regions, so the points on the equator, are actually moving about 1,000 miles per hour, typically.
Ouch.
It's about 1,600 kilometers per hour. It's quite fast. So to kind of illustrate the actual Coriolis effect happening, is it regulates fluid and air movements on the surface of the Earth, so on or across the Earth. So the Earth itself, the actual rock part of the Earth, is spinning. It's doing its normal thing. All the things are moving at the same velocity. But the fluids that are moving on the surface of the Earth have a bit of lag and delay to them and are getting, you know, held back in some places.
Sure.
So a good example would be like, say I want to throw a paper airplane. And I'm in Texas, for example, and I throw the paper airplane what I think is directly north. Well, because I'm standing in Texas and I'm throwing it north, maybe it lands in Kansas City, South Dakota, North Dakota, something like that.
Wow. Good for you.
Yeah. I got a good arm. Major leagues, baby.
Oh, yeah. David has giant, I mean, just giant arms.
He could
the rest
barely
of his body
fit through the door. Yeah.
So picture Smeagol, but with giant arms.
Like Dwayne The Rock Johnson arms on Smeagol.
Yeah.
So you throw in this paper airplane, it's going to land in, let's say, Kansas City. Kansas City is north of Texas, but because you are in Texas, which is closer to the equator, you're farther south, you're moving faster than the point where it lands in Kansas City. So you think you've thrown it exactly north, but it actually is going to end up landing somewhere like in Delaware because those point it hasn't caught up to that yet. So does that make sense?
Yeah. I think planes use this effect for their advantage, right?
Well, so they use the knowledge of how the winds are moving. So it does the Coriolis effect doesn't affect planes, and I'll come back to that in a second, but it affects the weather, which then in turn affects the planes. So pilots need to be aware of how the winds are moving to kind of get the best flight path.
Got it.
So if you're in the northern hemisphere, it's always going to, if you're throwing something directly north, it's going to curve to the right.
Oh.
Right? It's going to curve
like
towards
when I throw a ball.
Delaware. Yeah, just like when you throw a ball. If you throw it really, really hard, really fast, and really far north.
At Delaware.
Or
at Kansas
City. At Kansas City.
Hit Delaware.
Yeah. You want to hit Delaware? Throw something right at Kansas City.
First in the nation. First in my hatred.
So now, so picture yourself standing on the globe. You're in Texas. You've thrown it up towards Kansas City. Okay. And turn yourself exactly around 180 degrees to face towards the southern hemisphere, to face down to the south. Say you're standing in Peru now, and you're going to throw that same paper airplane straight south. Well, it's going to curve to the right.
Okay.
To the Pacific.
To the Pacific, yeah. Right. And in this case, I said to the right, but let's use the orientation of the airplane. So if we're the airplane now, and we're being thrown from Texas towards Kansas City, we're going to curve from the airplane's point of view to the right.
East.
If we're going downwards in Peru, from the airplane's point of view, we're going to curve to the left this time. So it's still east, right?
Yeah.
Oh, they both go east.
They both go east. So now take that sort of analogy and expand it to let's say a hurricane is a perfect example. You have a low pressure system right in the center, the eye of the hurricane. There's almost no pressure and lots of high pressure winds happening around that. Well, all those high pressure winds want to rush in and go zoom really fast to the center. So they're all pointed in towards the center. But mm-hmm. because of the way that the Earth is moving and those are really high speed winds and they're going over really far distances, the ones in the northern hemisphere are all going to shift ever so slightly to the right, just like our paper airplane did. And since they're all shifting to the right, it's going to, like, each wind is going to be curving to the right and eventually make this counterclockwise motion. I'm sitting opposite them, so everything's backwards.
But I show you the other way.
David's hands are really helpful. If you can log on right now to our Facebook Live post and realize that we forgot to start it and it's too late.
I will say, I got all of this from Nat Geo, NOAA, and NASA, and all of them have some great kind of videos and diagrams as well if you're confused. So that's how the Coriolis effect operates on the winds and the hurricanes and typhoons and even to some extent tornadoes. But the impact of the Coriolis effect is totally dependent on velocity. And it could be the velocity of either the Earth moving or the object or the fluid that's being kind of deflected in some way. So because of that large difference between an object's velocity and the ground's velocity, the effect is going to increase the higher the speed or the longer the distance.
Okay.
Meaning, if you're going to go all the way down to the scale of a sink with water in it, it's going to be
such a small distance.
Yeah, basically negligible, that it won't be able to overpower even the tiniest little change in the manufacturer's, you know, sink or the smoothness of the tub or the drain, however it might be in a toilet, right? So tiny little differences like that, temperature changes, if your house is slightly tilted or slanted, right? If you put a bucket of water on a not flat surface, all of these things are going to be way more significant than the Coriolis effect on something such a small scale.
Right.
There have been two fairly serious studies in science. I think everything in science is serious, but when you're talking about the way that water circulates, slightly less serious.
There were three really funny ones.
But I thought not to cite those, just to keep credibility. And these two allowed the water to settle for about 18 hours in their thing, and they checked all the variables, temperature, the smoothness of the vat, the vehicle in which the water was moving, and they found that, yes, if you did keep, this is why I said 99%, if you did keep everything completely controlled as much as possible, then you probably would see some effect of the way that it spins caused by the Coriolis effect.
Okay.
In other words, you would see the water moving counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere, clockwise in the southern.
I imagine these vats are also very big. Going back to your, like, distance thing.
Yeah, so I saw Veritaserum did one. They tried to keep everything constant and controlled, and they used a pretty large-size kiddie pool. So it wasn't huge, but it was a good size.
Bigger.
Yeah. And they did a cool thing. They did all the things that I was mentioning where they tried not to move the water or touch the water, and they let it settle. They put the water in. When they first put it in the pool, they put it in the opposite direction that they were anticipating it would spin before letting it settle, just to make sure that wouldn't
try to neglect it.
Yeah, that there wouldn't be still movement from before. And then they let it go and they put food coloring in lines to see how the food coloring, how the water would move. It was really, it's good, a good graphic. It's a good way to see
Shout out to Veritaserum. Their channel is awesome. Yeah. And it's full of scientific, he has like a PhD in like essentially scientific misconceptions. It's really cool.
Oh man, that's a cool PhD. That's an awesome one.
Yeah.
So it was really cool. So it will have some effect on it if you had everything completely controlled, but that is almost never the case in a sink or a tub or a toilet.
Right. Well, thanks, David.
Yeah.
Nicely done. Well,
go ahead.
One more thing. Sorry.
Go ahead.
So a lot of this is because of the way that the Earth spins, right? And it is dependent on the speed of the Earth. And I was saying it would increase if the Earth was moving faster, right? Mm-hmm. The effect would be different. So there are other planets which do spin faster than Earth. For example, Jupiter, surprisingly, is the fastest spinning planet.
I have never thought about different planet speeds before.
Right?
Yeah.
Isn't that cool?
No. Yeah.
So Jupiter spins crazy fast. I think its day is like 10 hours long. So it does one full revolution within 10 Earth hours.
Okay.
Which for how big it is very scary.
Oh
so if you imagine those speeds moving around, potentially, let's imagine a world in which Jupiter was a rock planet and you can actually stand on it and throw a paper airplane or drain a tub, then it probably would have an effect on something like that because it moves so fast.
So if you open up your sink or drain your sink on Jupiter, it's going to go the opposite direction.
Stay tuned for 10 episodes later where I come back from my mission to Jupiter.
I was going to say, if anyone's on Jupiter listening, we'd love to hear from you as well. Don't pan your leg at gmail.com. Well, now it's time for the last segment, which is something that we're consuming, reading, watching, listening to this week. So let's have David go first. What's something that you've been consuming recently?
I will put a plug for multitask binging.
Say more.
I've been watching like 4 different TV shows simultaneously. And what? I don't mean simultaneously. Oh, okay. I mean like...
Like picture in picture and picture in picture.
Yes. One of them has been very small. So I'm going to say like the 4 TV shows that I've been watching is Modern Family, because everyone says it was great and I've been catching up. It's good. I like it. The Crown, the newest season of The Crown on Netflix. Crane. So good. Mm-hmm. So good. Mm-hmm. The Morning Show on Apple TV.
With Reese Witherspoon and...
Steve Carell and Jennifer Aniston.
Steve Carell. Yeah,
yeah, it's really good. And Billy Crudup is amazing. And then what's the fourth one? There was a fourth one. What was the fourth one? The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Amazon Prime. So I see what I did. I shared the network love there.
Yes, you did. That was great. And so you've been watching them kind of like jumping around between them. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's probably healthy to do. That way you're not like devastated when one of them ends. You've got more.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. And I had a lot of long plane rides, so I didn't want to watch the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, second plug on this show for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Really?
Who plugged it last?
Peter.
Oh, Peter.
Back in episode like 4.
Yeah. Season 3 just came out like 2 weeks ago, and it's quite good.
Ooh.
I want to watch it, but sometimes I feel like if I didn't start a TV show when everyone else did, then I just like am impossibly behind. Mm-hmm. You know,
like that's only true for huge, like that would be true for like a Game of Thrones or a I don't know, something major.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, I'll try it. We really will try it.
It's pretty bingeable too.
Okay. Kimin, what are you consuming?
Speaking of spooky.
Don't say my thing. Don't say my thing. Don't say my thing.
Synthesizers. Am I going to talk about to start with L?
Yes.
Luigi's Mansion. All right. So Margaret and I have both been consuming a brand new spoopy game.
Excuse me?
As Brooke from, who is now in tie with you, I don't think coined it, but told us the word spoopy, which is spooky but cute.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that checks out. Well, sounds like spooky but poopy.
We'll run it back. All right, Brooke. Well, we've got someone calling you out right on the leaderboard.
I mean, she's my rival now, so I have to go against everything she says.
Sure.
Margaret, tell the folks about our consumption.
Well, this is one of those things that I feel like I did not see. Like I didn't have video games when I was little, and so now I'm just like catching up to all the things that other people kind of commonly know. So I had never played Luigi's Mansion. I only played Mario Kart in high school when I like played it with Camden. And so it's really fun to play Luigi's Mansion on the Switch. You're exploring this mansion and you're trying to save Peach and Mario, who are like trapped in a painting by King Boo. You know how you sometimes that happens at resorts.
Oops, I've fallen into a painting and I can't get out.
So it's like, it's challenging in a way that's not, it's like, okay, I need to solve this puzzle, but it's not like, oh, I'm stuck. Like I'm so stuck and I'm frustrated. It's just like a sugary little video game that I really have enjoyed. So.
And for the original connoisseurs, when I played Luigi's Mansion back in like high school, or middle school, it's like most Mario games where it was just like you're on your own. It's like a solo adventure game. But in this game, you get to be Gooigi, which is an uncomfortable word.
Right.
And so you can co-op play. So Margaret and I can both play at the same time.
Oh, yeah. Very nice.
So
when you say Gooigi, I picture a Luigi formed blob coming out of the Ghostbusters canon, plasma canon.
Honestly, David, you've kind of got it.
I mean, it's a gooey version. It's like a jello Luigi, but instead of coming out of like the ghost canon, it's like a crab molt. It comes out of Luigi's back. Like it just like steps backward out of Luigi. That is weird.
It is uncomfortable though too, because when you play it on the solo mode, Luigi, when you step out of Luigi, you can't control two people at once with one controller.
And so Luigi goes, oh.
And he sort of becomes lifeless, like you've like removed the like life
soul,
essence
from
him.
Yeah. From him.
But then the goo part has structure to it. I'm picturing like one of those giant Haribo gummy bears, but Luigi.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And he makes
can
a fun
fit
little,
through grates.
As he walks around, it's like.
Fun little? What no.
Well, since we only have about, 7 minutes left in this recording space, David, do you have anything you want to plug?
Oh, Yes, I will plug Audio Obscura is a podcast that I do with my dear friend Michael Foster. I think I plugged it last time too, but I'll plug it again.
It's still happening.
And actually, if you listen to episode, I don't remember, 15, 16?
Maybe.
We do one on, I'm kind of giving it away. It's an audio mystery podcast, but I'm going to give it away.
That's fine.
On morgues and morticians and like what happens to the body after death. That's how I knew about the sewing the thing.
See, I'm going to have to listen to that Audio Obscura to find out which podcast that is because...
It's a YouTube series called with Kate Doherty.
Is it Ask a Mortician?
Yes, it's Ask a Mortician.
Yep.
I was like, you've probably seen it before.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so Audio Obscura, everywhere where podcasts can be found.
And we're excited to maybe try to jump back onto that leaderboard too.
Heck yeah.
Is there? Have you had any double guests?
Yes, Anne Cuddy for the first time just guested for the second time.
Okay. So that's the first. So we got to get back to the leaderboard of two. We want to be in tie with her.
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. We're also thinking of having a big giant, this is maybe off the air, you can edit this out, like a giant bash with all the people who have guested before we can celebrate our 1 year because our 1 year is coming up. So.
Like a fight.
Oh, a battle royale.
Yeah.
Ooh. Kind of out.
Kind of
Oh, God. So thank you so much, everyone, for listening today. You can hear more content like this from our Sister Wife podcast, From Ooh to Oh, hosted by me. Don't Pee on Your Leg and Other Scientific Misconceptions is a podcast produced by Two Birds, One Scone. Articles, blog posts, and more about what you can do every day to conserve our environment can be found at twobirdsonescone.org. It also really helps us out if, when you listen to this podcast, if you would rate, review, and subscribe, because we really appreciate your comments. And thank you in advance.
Yeah. Our original music is by Camillo. And speaking about comments, if you have some scientific misconceptions you'd like explained, or just want to provide feedback to us, please email us at don'tpeeonyourleg@gmail.com.
Have a great week.
Oh no.
Margaret, hit the button you've been waiting to hit.
Is that the, are you ready for this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like how you built a laugh into your synth button.
Yeah. Also, the synth has like full songs, huh?
Yeah.
This isn't my first synth rodeo.
Synth rodeo
is a band name. Thodio.
Synth Rodeo is a great band name.
That is
also
a good
the name of my new synth like nighttime talk show. I will my host name will be Synth Rodeo.
Oh, all right, really. Goodbye.
Bye.